Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 23rd of September. The author of Red State, Blue State, Rich State, Poor State, Why Americans Vote the Way They Do, Professor Andrew Gelman, is our guest this hour. Professor of Statistics and Political Science at Columbia University. Books include Teaching Statistics, A Bag of Tricks. He's written a lot of other books as well. He's received the Outstanding Statistical Application Award from the American Statistical Association, has done research on many topics. Get these. Why it's rational to vote, why campaign polls are so variable when elections are so predictable, why redistricting is good for democracy, reversals of death sentences, police stops in New York City, the statistical challenges of estimating small effects, the probability that your vote will be decisive, seats and votes in Congress, arsenic in Bangladesh, radon in your basement, toxicology, and many other areas. The book explodes the myths that we have pickup driving red state Republicans who vote based on God, guns, and gays, and elitist blue state Democrats who are woefully out of touch with heartland values. Why Democrats win elections in wealthy states while Republicans get the votes of richer voters, and how the two parties have become ideologically polarized. How the real culture war is being waged among affluent Democrats and Republicans, not between the haves and the have-nots. How religion matters for higher income voters, and how the rich-poor divide is greater in red and not blue states. That's some of what we find in this book. Professor Andrew Gelman, thank you very much for being with us.
A pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So we have these myths. Blow them down for us. We have, because I think a lot of people think this, we got the pickup driving red state Republicans, and we got the elitist blue state Democrats who are out of touch with heartland values. The story is a bit deeper than that.
Oh, yeah. Well, it starts out with people noticing real patterns. So after the 2000 election in particular, it was clear that the Democrats are winning the richer states in the Northeast and the West Coast, and Republicans are winning states in the South and the middle of the country. And then the upper Midwest, of course, such as Wisconsin, was being split. And that is actually the upper Midwest is a middle-income area of the country. So geographically, rich states are Democratic and poor states are Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And people from there leap to the conclusion that rich people are Democrats, but that's actually not true. That the richer Americans vote 15-20% more Republican than poor Americans do, and that's been happening for decades. So what's going on among individual voters is not the same as what's going on when you look at states.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about rich states, what do you mean by a rich state?
I'm talking about the states where family income is higher than average or in the top third. States like Connecticut is the richest, and New Jersey, California, New York, a bunch of those states. The poorer states are ones that have traditionally been poor and rural, like Mississippi, West Virginia, and a whole bunch of others.
Mm-hmm. And in poor states, rich people vote much more Republican than poor people. In rich states, rich and poor people don't differ so much in how they vote.
That's right. That a rich person in Mississippi is much more Republican than a poor person in Mississippi. A rich person in Connecticut is more conflicted. Rich people in Connecticut tend to be economically conservative and socially liberal, and they're a little bit torn, and indeed they go pretty much 50-50 between the parties.
Mm-hmm. So then what, the issues become more important in those areas? Is it issues that are determining this?
Politics as a whole has become more issue-focused in the last 30 years, and in the 70s, it was much more possible to be a liberal Republican or to be a conservative Democrat, mm-hmm. and there aren't so many of those left out there. I mean, someone like Joe Lieberman makes a lot of news, but back in the 70s, there were a lot more members of Congress and a lot more voters who were in the center like that.
What does all of what's going on in Wall Street and it have to do with how we may be voting this time? We've talked about the upheaval in the market. Is it making a lot of rich people quite a bit poorer, so they're going to fall into a different kind of voting pattern this go around, or do we not know yet what the fallout will be?
It's safe to say it's too early to know, but in general, bad economic news is bad for the incumbent party. So I don't think this is good for the Republicans. The funny thing is that although the richest Americans are strongly Republican, going from survey data and even if you go to political contributions of the Forbes 400, the richer you are, the more Republican you are. Wall Street is one of the few industries where there are a lot of high income Democrats, but I don't see any evidence that the Republicans are going to get much electoral credit from the fact that a bunch of hedge fund traders are Democrats.
Right. And the richer you are, the more Republican you are, because why? What are they doing for you? Making you richer?
I wouldn't say it's just a straight, like, I voted for George Bush because he gave me a $2,000 tax cut, that kind of thing. Just historically, the parties stand for different things, and rich people do tend to be more conservative economically. Now, there's a lot of reasons why, if you're successful, you're probably more likely to support the economic system that we have. But I wouldn't call it naked self-interest as much as just being consistent with one's ideology.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say that in the 1950s and early 1960s, in the era of Eisenhower and Kennedy, there was very little difference between how rich and poor people voted. And Eisenhower was a political moderate whose most notable economic action was to not try to shut down Social Security the way a lot of Republicans wanted at the time. And John Kennedy was a moderate Democrat whose most notable economic act was a tax cut. Now, since then, the parties have really moved apart, and you know, the voters are responding to that.
Mm-hmm. And did it start with Ronald Reagan and a different kind of economic philosophy?
Ronald Reagan sort of continued the trend, but even throughout the 70s, the parties were already starting to move apart on economic issues in particular.
And what about the candidates that we have now? We've got, when we look at tax plans, we have very different proposals on the table here, with John McCain offering significant tax breaks for people who are in that really high 0.1%, and the upper 10% are going to get a lot of tax breaks under his plan. Obama would get tax breaks to those who are more middle-income workers, and tax, some would say, quite heavily those who are in the upper reaches of their finances. What does that say?
I think the difference in the economic policies of the two parties is consistent with what's been going on in the past. My guess is that the Democrats are slightly to the left of the average voter economically, and the Republicans are slightly to the right, although it's different for different issues, but on aggregate, that's true. The Republicans are a bit more to the right than the Democrats are to the left. And our estimate is that if the Democrats tried to move economically, it wouldn't change their vote much. That is, there are some people who say if only the Democrats would have a true populist position, they would win a lot more votes because the voters would love that. But there's not a lot of evidence for that. And there's also not a lot of evidence that the Democrats would gain by moving to the center economically. They're not in a bad place. But Republicans are further to the right economically than what the voters want on most issues.
Mm-hmm.
And they are paying the price for that, in elections. They managed to win some elections. It's not the ultimate price that they've been paying, but I think it does hurt them a little bit at the polls.
Right. And considering all the news that's been dominating the last couple of weeks, as we look at the salaries of people who are getting severance packages for running businesses into the ground, $30 million, $40 million, et cetera, what are the ramifications for those people who are – we just did a show on healthcare and how many people are having real struggles with trying to find plans that they can afford and their deductibles going up, et cetera, and losing their savings because things weren't paid for. Can you take me through what that means for voting, to have that kind of disparity in this country?
It's hard for me to answer that one because the conclusions that we have are pretty much based on historical analysis. So when you have these unique events like this current stock market situation, it's hard to know. Like, I can't say, if you want to ask me things like, well, how come Obama is not ahead in the polls by 15 points?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, everybody hates Bush. He's the least popular president ever. Even a lot of Republicans can't stand the guy. The economy isn't going well. So how come Obama isn't just trashing McCain? Does that mean Obama's running a horrible campaign? That I can answer because I can give some historical perspective on the closeness of elections in the past. But how voters are dealing with, how voters are specifically connecting, like health care costs with corporate compensation, that's a little bit trickier, sort of outside of what we discussed.
Mm-hmm. And what about the closeness of elections? You write about the fact that they are getting closer.
Yeah, well, if you look historically, when you have a challenger, Obama, coming from the other party, you typically don't get landslides. If you look at the landslide elections in the past 60 years, they've all been situations like Reagan's reelection, or Lyndon Johnson's reelection or Nixon's reelection, when it's been the economy has been going okay and the president's running for reelection and he sweeps. But when you find, even in situations where the economy hasn't been going so great, the out party, the challengers, never do that well, just historically. And that's why I thought that, like, considering what's been going on in the past, it's not a surprise. I would expect Obama to win. I think that the economic and political conditions favor him, but there's no reason to think that it wouldn't be close. There's a lot of people, you know, on both sides of the issues in the United States, and that's shown in the maps and so forth.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about national polls? What do you think about state polls? Do you read them?
I don't read state polls. I think, or national polls. When you're talking about a couple weeks before the election, sure, they're informative. But how people vote is pretty predictable based on how they voted in the past, how the states have voted in the past, and economic conditions. And I think people are really, like, well, taking, for example, after the Republican convention, John McCain moved up in the polls by 10 points. And there was a lot of discussion of the Christian conservatives liking Sarah Palin and deciding that they supported McCain. Well, that's fine, but if McCain had not nominated her, if he had picked somebody else, I think the social conservatives still would have eventually gone to support McCain. They still would have gone to the Republican Party. It just might have taken longer. It affected the timing, but I don't think it affected the outcome. And a lot of this chasing the poll has to do with people making their decisions at some point or another.
Hmm. Oh, that's interesting. But so does that not mean then some of the issues that she has brought to the table here, which may be contrary to McCain's positions in some ways, but some of making issues like abortion, making issues like global warming, et cetera, more important because of her stance on this, what does that do to everything?
Well, I think the issues that favor McCain, I think he would have brought up anyway. The issues that favor Obama, Obama would have found a way to bring up. Obama didn't need Sarah Palin in order to say that he supports abortion rights in a way that John McCain doesn't. And that might be a way that becomes salient to some voters. But the campaign, that's their job, is really to delineate each other by pointing out the areas where the other party is out of step with the majority, and they're good at doing that.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk, because race has been brought up in this and what this means for the election. You talk about Americans having systematic misperceptions about the economic status of different groups, and some of these are amazing. Government statistics show whites on average earn 60% more than blacks. They're far more likely to have medical insurance and more than twice as likely to graduate from college. How does that play into politics, Professor Gelman?
Well, as surveys have shown, white Americans have a lot of advantages over blacks, but they don't always realize that. So when you poll white people and you ask them, are blacks doing worse than whites? A lot of whites don't even think that's true. They're not. So in many ways, white people and ethnic minorities are living in different perceptual countries, seeing different things. Also, people in whites and blacks and Latinos and Asians, for that matter, all tend to overestimate the percentage of minorities in this country. So your listeners can ask themselves, what percent of Americans do they think are black, Latino, Asian? So you can think about that for a moment. When Americans are surveyed, on average, they think that 25% of Americans are black, but it's actually 12%.
Hmm.
And they similarly overestimate other minority groups.
Why do they do that?
Well, I think a part of it's got to be that it's hard for people to understand small probabilities. But beyond that, I don't have a great answer, but it happens in other countries too. There's a cross-national survey where they ask people in a bunch of developed countries what percentage of people in the country were immigrants from other countries. And in the United States, 10% of Americans or 12% of Americans are foreign-born, but the average American thinks 28% are foreign-born.
Oh, my.
But it's the same in France and Germany and the United Kingdom. In the UK, Britons think that 25% are foreign-born. It's actually 8%. So there's definitely a perception out there among the minority and the majority both of that some of these divisions are really larger than they actually are.
Mm-hmm. And what was the part of the book that was fascinating? If you have a certain strongly held belief about an issue and you're confronted with facts that should change your opinion about something, you tend to become even more rigid in your belief that things are the way you originally thought they were.
Right. That my co-author Joe Bafumi calls the stubborn American voter. There's some long tradition in political science, like the American voter, and then people modify it from that. Well, yeah, so it's not a surprise that how you view the economy, say, is affected by your partisan allegiance. So Kathleen, if you're a Democrat and I ask how the economy is going, you might say it's going pretty badly. Now, suppose that Obama is elected and then it's January 23rd, 2009, he's been president for a couple of days, and the economy hasn't changed. And I ask you how the economy is going. You might say it's going better. And that could be rational because you're forward-looking. And you could say, well, I think that the current economy with George Bush and et cetera in charge isn't going well, but I think the current economy with the Democrats in charge, maybe there's a strong foundation. So it's, in a way, it is perfectly rational for people to believe their side a little bit more, to discount other evidence. What was interesting, that what Joe found that we put in the book, was that there's more of this than there used to be. And so, again, back in the 60s and 70s, people had less of a partisan filter on these things. And you'll see that in other things. The belief that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, that as late as 2006, over 30% of Republicans thought that Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and only about less than 10% of Democrats. But if you look at views about the Vietnam War or the Korean War, the gap between the parties was much smaller.
Isn't that interesting? So it's somewhat discouraging, isn't it? No matter what you say, you still can't get the truth out there?
Oh, it is very frustrating. And there, although part of the frustration is about outcomes. So the former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, when he was stepping down from Congress, said, quote, "The common lament over the recent rise in political partisanship is often nothing more than a veiled complaint instead about the recent rise of political conservatism." Now, I don't agree with Tom DeLay about a lot of things, but I think he was sort of right about that, that if you feel that policies aren't going the way you want, then there is a tendency to be frustrated with the political process. If you thought that policies were in the direction that you liked, I think you'd be more likely to accept it and say, oh, sure, there's biases, but they tend to cancel out, and the government serves the will of the people, and so forth. It's very hard to separate those.
We're going to take phone calls, and we'll do them in a moment. The author of Red State, blue state, rich state, poor state, why Americans vote the way they do. Professor Andrew Gelman is our guest this hour. He's a professor of statistics and political science at Columbia University. Books include Teaching Statistics, A Bag of Tricks. He received the President's Award in 2003, awarded each year to the best statistician under the age of 40. And he has just a wide range of interest in so many topics. We are going to take your phone calls, and here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now, Professor Gelman, and start with Scott from Menominee. Hi, Scott.
Good morning. Great program. I'm probably going to show my political bias pretty openly, but I'm wondering about when tax policy started being used as a wedge and a divisive issue. I agree there's way too much partisanship. There's a tremendous amount of divisiveness, and the thing that's always driven me nuts is hearing politicians say, you know, the phrase tax cuts for the rich, or they need to pay their fair share. And that's an attempt to pit one group against another group. And I've always hated that because it's politics of division. Why is it always that their fair share means obviously they need to pay more? The attempt to say tax cuts for the rich is an attempt to say that the guy down the street should be paying more than you, and you should feel good about it if we do that, if we raise his taxes. And it's always, I've always found that to be an extremely divisive tool and tactic, and I'm wondering, when did that start? When did they start trying to pit people against each other with that particular tactic?
Andrew?
Well, let me flip it around and ask you this. Why isn't there more of that tactic? That's in some ways the bigger surprise, that why can't the lower 51% of income tax the upper 49% to oblivion? And in the 1930s, Franklin Roosevelt's advisor was said to have coined the phrase, tax and tax, spend and spend, elect and elect. And it seemed like a magic formula. Now, sometime in the 1970s, there was a bit of a shift, and taxes became discredited. Think maybe things have been swinging back now, but the policy of trying to get the money by taxing the rich is just logical because the rich people have more of the money, and if you can manage to get everybody else to vote for you, then that's going to work. And I think what happened in the 1970s was there was an ideological shift. There was a general belief that high rates of taxation were economically inefficient, and that was enough to swing the balance. But it's always going to be a tension there. To what extent that can be used as a political tool, and it really has to depend ultimately on how much voters at all income levels think that high taxing is a reasonable economic strategy, and how much they think it's counterproductive.
Anything else, Scott?
Well, I don't mind it in that way as an economic tool. My complaint with it is it being used as a divisive tool. If the attempt to pit one group of people against another group of people,
but anyone's going to do that, right? If you think you're in the majority, you want to pit yourself against the minority. So I think that's the point: is that if the lower income, if the lower 60% of income people were actually convinced that taxing the rich was going to work, then more of it would be done. I mean, because being divisive, if you consider yourself in the majority, being divisive is really a plus, not a minus.
Right, and I understand that. My point is, I just don't think it's right. I mean, I try and look at issues of being right and wrong, and if we're talking about why things are so divisive, I mean, that's one of the reasons there is. There's an attempt to divide, in both parties, and with different tactics. I just don't like the approach of trying to divide people on issues like that.
Well, people are a lot more moderate than you'd expect from their demographics. And there is a difference between how rich and poor vote, but rich people are a lot of rich people are economically liberal and a lot of lower income people are economically conservative. And so I do agree that like trying to divide people like might look good on paper, but in reality it doesn't always work that well because people aren't so clearly divided. There are a lot more moderates. There are a lot more moderates among the voters than there are in Congress, actually.
Thanks, Scott, for the call. Ken from Milton. Hi.
Hello. I think the reason we have a 50-50 split is because of this phenomenon, which I can't remember what it's called, but political scientists have discovered it, where if a fact concerning the opposite party or person running is refuted or changed, the people that believe or is changed and refuted, denied, whatever, the people that believe that after it is refuted and changed believe it even stronger.
Yeah, we talked some about that a few minutes ago. You want to add to that, Andrew?
As we said, it is very frustrating that sometimes people seem impervious to the facts. And it's not completely new. And there was survey data from 1988 where people were asked what they thought had happened with inflation and unemployment in the previous 8 years. And between 1980 and 1988, unemployment went down a bit and inflation went down a lot. That was one of the major achievements of Paul Volcker in the Federal Reserve in the early 80s. So the interesting thing is that half of the Democrats surveyed in 1988 didn't think that inflation had improved much. But it was right in front of them, but they didn't want to believe it. So, and we already talked about the Republicans and the weapons of mass destruction. It happens on both sides. I think things do shift, though. Sometimes it's slow. It takes a while, and maybe that's a good thing that it takes a while. It's some stability in our political system.
Mm-hmm. Let's look at John Kerry in 2004. You asked the question: could John Kerry have gained votes in the recent presidential election by more clearly distinguishing himself from George W. Bush on economic policy? At first thought, the logic of political preferences would suggest not. On second thought, fill in the blank.
Right. So, yeah, the first thought would be that, there's sort of two takes on what Democratic strategy should be in the economy. And one take is distinguish yourself from the Republicans, present a clear choice. And the other piece of advice is be one iota to the left of the Republicans. So be just like the Republicans, but throw out like one or two populist things like the minimum wage, and then you'll get all the moderate votes as well as the votes on the left. And the point is that both of these pieces of advice, although they're contradictory, have some validity, that there are more voters in the middle than on the left. A lot of voters are economically moderate, and the Democrats could lose some of them by moving to the left. On the other hand, if they make themselves completely indistinguishable from the Republicans except for a minor tinker, that's not going to work either. And one reason is voters don't read every policy position. And so if the Democrats present themselves as a party that's a carbon copy of the Republicans with one tiny change, voters aren't necessarily going to perceive that. Maybe what they will perceive is the similarity. But actually, Kerry already was pretty distinct from Bush in economic policy. So he didn't really need to move further to the left. That wouldn't have done him any good. He was reasonably well-positioned as it is. And I think a lot of activists don't realize that. A lot of activists sort of feel that the parties are Tweedledum and Tweedledee, but when you look at a number of issues, really the Democrats do tend to be to the left of most voters and the Republicans tend to be to the right of most of the voters. The parties are more clearly separated than an activist might think.
Thanks, Ken, for the call. Let's go next to Sandy from Heartland. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to voice my frustration with the media right now. I know everybody's always saying the media is so for the Democrats and so liberal, but I disagree. I think, I'm a Democrat, but I live in a very conservative area. And I just hear a lot of conversations around me about, you know, how they're hearing all these things, and they all listen to Fox News, and it's like they're glued to that station, and I watch Fox News, and I cannot believe the misinformation on there. And I know, you know, a lot of it's coming directly from the Republicans. They're feeding into that station, and they're coming out with these things over and over again that are wrong about McCain and Obama. And I just wonder if there's any way to that's going to get fixed. How that can go on like that?
Well, in some ways, Fox News is a return to an earlier tradition in the American press. That the press used to be a lot more partisan. And their newspapers, there used to be Democratic and Republican newspapers in major cities, and you could decide what newspaper to read based on your politics, and that's still true in Europe. So that, you know, that might be the future, that there might be more news outlets that more explicitly favor one party or the other. In our book, we talk a bit about implicit biases in the news media, biases that are neither left nor right, but biases that occur because the places where the national media live in D.C. suburbs and New York and California are just different from the rest of the country in many ways. They're atypical. And so I think that the media on both sides, the left and the right and the center for that matter, all of them tend to make consistent mistakes in understating the differences between how rich and poor vote. And some other things, which I think have to do with where they're located.
Mm-hmm. Well, they can't even get our time zone right.
Well, that I can't comment on, except I did appear on time today.
I know you did. I'm not blaming you. It's just all those other elitists, right, on the East Coast. Because this has been so much in the news, I don't know if this is a picky thing, but I wonder how it plays into economics. And, of course, we're a country that loves celebrity. Does it make a difference in terms of poor people seeing candidates who may have, you know, 7 houses and 13 cars because they see themselves as being on the road eventually because this is America, and so they would be more likely to maybe moderate voters or what voters would be motivated by that to vote Republican this particular round, whereas we have another candidate who is identifying more with community organizer with the poor, you know, has 1 house, doesn't have all that many cars, etc. Is that all just kind of a lot of hooey, or is there something to that, and who would be more likely to vote for those personalities who have a display of that kind of wealth?
What I think is that the evidence is that people vote based on where the parties stand on the issues and based on their economic and social ideologies, pretty much what they believe. I think that the business of the 7 houses and the 13 cars, it's relevant in that it's a way for Obama to signal, to say, look, I'm more supporting the working person and McCain is more supporting upper income people. It's a way for Obama to say I'm a Democrat and so making that claim. I mean, and that's basically what it's about. I mean, the goal of McCain in this campaign is to remind voters that Obama is a liberal, because there's a lot more conservatives in this country than liberals, and Obama is a liberal. And the goal of Obama is to remind voters that McCain is a Republican, because there are a lot more Democrats than Republicans in this country. And again, it's a true fact. I don't think there's a lot of people who are going to determine their vote based on the fact that McCain owns a lot of houses. I think that the campaigns throw these things out. It's a way to sort of stick it in your brain. It's a way to have a little story. And I mean, I can tell you a story. I was teaching at Harvard last semester, and I had a colleague in the economics department who was telling me that he moved out of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he had a 5-year-old child. And I said, is it because of the school system? And he said, well, partly that, but partly it's because he didn't like being the only Republican family on their block. So I said, where did you go? He moved to a leafy suburb, and he said it was the best he could do, 35% Republican. That's the best he could do in the Boston suburbs. And so, okay, so that's a story. It's a true story, and it gives you a sense of the geographic divisions and the fact that, people can move to where they want to move sometimes. Lower-income people probably aren't deciding where they want to live based on how Democratic or Republican it is. They're probably picking what bus line is nearby and things like that. And where does grandma live?
Mm-hmm.
She can help babysit.
Yes.
Okay? An upper-income person can pick based on that. Now, my story conveyed no real information that the statistics don't convey, but you'll remember it. And that's what I think the seven houses and the 11 cars are doing. They're serving a function, but a symbolic one.
Right. Thanks, Sandy, for your call. Jeff from Madison. Hi.
Yes, this is really interesting, and I was thinking about this earlier. I think fairness and equity or equality are important values for, I think, most Americans, or at least they would say that. And yet what really causes, for me and perhaps I think many others, is perceived hypocrisy or actual hypocrisy. And I was saying to the screener, Joy, we heard three counts of it this morning on your shows. The first professor was talking about the bailout of banks as not socialization, but a necessary thing to help the country, help the poor, help the mortgage. And then when you asked him about CEO pay, he said, well, most people believe in free market principles. And then when we went to the health discussion, we talked about health for all, and some people called in and said, well, that's socialization, and that shouldn't be. And others said, the one person who said quite astutely, I thought, well, we socialize, if you will, the police and fire departments. Why not health? So, I mean, it's perceived hypocrisy, and we hear it all the time, including those three times on your show this morning, which was really funny. Anyway, I'll just listen off the air now. Thanks.
Well, yeah, ideologies are not consistent. I mean, it's not physics, right? I mean, that's the difficulty. When you survey Americans and ask if they support a flat tax, people support it, but then if you say, well, having a flat tax means that rich people are going to pay less than they used to, then people no longer support it, right? And so I think that, I mean, an example we came across recently, some colleagues of mine in the political science department, we looked at gay rights. Now, you might remember that in his acceptance speech, Obama actually mentioned gay rights and said that we should live in a country where you can't discriminate against gays. Now, you might think that's the stupidest thing in the world for him to say because everybody knows that gay rights is a hot-button issue. It turns out that 75% of Americans think there should be a law to make discrimination against gays illegal. They support anti-discrimination laws. In all but 10 states, over 70% of the voters support anti-discrimination laws, but actually only 20 states have such laws. Because people have values of non-discrimination. That's a very important American value right now. On the other hand, if you ask people, should gays be allowed to be elementary school teachers, half of Americans say no, because that's a different value, and you have these clashes. And you can't make policy based on that, right? You can't make a law saying you can't discriminate against gays, but they can't be teachers.
Exactly.
But the courts would have to resolve that. But at the level of public opinion, you can have that kind of inconsistency. And also, obviously, in public discourse, when people are trying to sell you something, they'll pick the values that match what they're trying to push.
We're going to welcome more phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, nobody's done that this hour, but feel free. That's talk@wpr.org. The author of Red State, Blue State, Rich State, Poor State, Why Americans Vote the Way They Do, Andrew Gelman, is our guest, professor of statistics and political science at Columbia University. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls now for Andrew Gelman, and our next call is Kathy from Waupaca. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, a couple of points here. The use of polls, for one thing, in my opinion, but I think polls are basically lazy journalism. It's a rather cheap and easy way to get to fill in a few seconds in a news story, and you really don't have to do any research and talk about hard things like positions or issues. You can just say, well, X number of people support this. And it sounds like news. Second point, a little disingenuous to claim that Republicans, or excuse me, Democrats are, you know, playing off of people's economic prejudice, pitting one side against another. Republicans have been basically taking people's social issues, social prejudices, and playing to those. This is how they can manage to get the votes of people whom they really don't represent, such as people in the lower income brackets. But you can talk about things like illegal immigration. You can talk about, oh, gays, whatever. And, you know, you can get your votes that way. So I'll just take my answers off the air.
All right, Kathy, thanks.
Well, with regard to the first comment about polls, I do agree. I mean, I use polls all the time, and polls are great, but I think there are too many of them. And there is our new phrase of the week is moral hazard, and I think there's a moral hazard in polls because they survey you, and the survey respondents answer for free, and then the pollsters make money off of it. So it doesn't seem quite right to me. And in the 1950s, if you were surveyed by the Gallup poll, and George Gallup is a very eloquent defender of polls and how polls advance democracy. Right? So President Eisenhower could read the latest polls and know what the people thought. He didn't have to do what the majority thought, but isn't that better than having a bunch of political operatives on the streets telling him? It's more information. Back in the 1950s, if you were to respond to a Gallup poll and be one of 1,500 people answering, you could really legitimately have a chance of influencing national policy. Right? You could be the respondent who makes the, you know, who you're giving your opinion about the Korean War or whatever it is, and people would listen. Nowadays, there's so many surveys that I once saw an article where they polled people to ask how often they had been polled in the past year. And it was something like one or two times. So it is, I do agree it's out of control, and I think economics is part of it. It's just so cheap to do it now, and people are doing more of it. And I'd like to feel like I'm doing my part by telling people not to chase the polls, don't take it too seriously, and I'm hoping that at some point there will be enough of that, people feeling that way, that journalists will do less of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with regard to your second comment, I think, as I said before, I think it is, like, in some sense, divisive politics is a perfectly legitimate thing to do if there are differences of opinion in the population and you feel your side has more than half. Then it seems quite legitimate to me to try to take advantage of that. With regard to cultural issues, the evidence is that it's higher income Americans rather than lower income who are more swayed by religious and cultural issues. And just as an example, so you said, well, there are some low income Americans who vote Republican maybe because of social issues. On the other hand, a lot of low income Americans also are economically conservative, and that could be their reason for voting that way. If you remember the Republican convention, those are a bunch of high income people who are obviously very stirred by social issues, and similarly the Democratic convention in its way. So it's really happening at all levels of the income scale, especially at the high end. You can use a wedge issue. Wedge issues work among richer voters, maybe even more than among poorer voters.
Mike is our next caller. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, good morning. I think to a large extent our economy is one of the casualties of this social divide we have in the country. I belong to that Unity 08 effort earlier in the year, hoping to get a Republican and a Democrat on a ticket to try to get some consensus, but that kind of failed. People are so polarized on social issues that, you know, when you get to Washington, it's simply impossible to get things passed. And I think we see that, for instance, with, you know, Democrats' effort to do away with redlining and such. We get the subprime loans, and we get millions of people into mortgages that shouldn't have had homes in the first place. They simply couldn't afford them. On the other side, Republicans, you know, tried to do away with all regulation. So, you know, these financial service companies, you know, ran haywire. The consequence is that we've got this position in Washington where we have low taxes, high spending for programs. We don't pay for anything. We simply borrow it, put it on our national credit card, and hand it to our kids. We got a $53 trillion debt we're handing to our kids. We can't do anything about it because we have no discipline. We're so polarized.
I think in the long run, of course, discipline can be established from external causes, whether they be military or environmental or financial. If people in other countries want to stop buying dollars, then somehow the system will be resolved one way or the other. But sure, I mean, I think that politics is going to be mostly based on pulling things to one side or the other. I mean, resolving issues like these are in many ways outside of the normal political process. They involve a kind of technical expertise, which isn't something that voters are going to be able to handle. Voters are trying to pick the party that they think can do it rather than making the decisions themselves.
Thanks, Mike. Claire from Milwaukee is next. Hi, Claire.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm a chemistry major from Madison, and my brother is a pediatrician. And I'm voting for McCain, and he's voting for Obama. The reason I'm voting for McCain is the Supreme Court. If Bork had not been shoved off, now we have Kennedy, and the Supreme Court voted to give a fair trial to our enemy, that's why I'm voting for McCain. But my brother, being a pediatrician, is voting for Obama. He believes his Obama's health program is better than McCain's. I'm looking into McCain seriously, into all the details. Thank you.
Thanks, Claire.
I guess I can say is that there's a lot of variation. I mean, so the fact that you're not voting the way you might expect based on your demographics is certainly fine. I think when we give our statistics, we often tend to understate the variation. So, for example, 60% of rich people vote Republican. So Republicans are as rich people are as Republican as the voters in Texas, for example. That's pretty Republican. But then there's still 40% vote the other way.
And rich people vote, don't they, in large numbers?
The richest 10% of the population represents about 15% of the
electorate. Oh, my goodness. That's surprising to me.
So they do vote more than lower income. But, yeah, there's a lot of variation, and it's good to remember that, especially in a state like Wisconsin, which is right in the middle. You don't maybe see as much of that in New York or Texas.
Thanks, Claire. We go to Wayne from Holman. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Wayne.
And to your guests. Hey, John deserves a raise, by the way, your screener. Quickly.
Yeah, he could. That'd be easy to give him because he's a volunteer.
He's a I just wonder, and I guess I'd like your guest to comment quickly. The two folks that said Fox News, and they get ripped quite a bit by some of the callers that they're unfair and biased, but two folks on Fox that presented Fox News as far as their fairness or unfairness in the primary campaign between Hillary and Barack said that Fox News was the fairest of all the networks, and those two people are Terry McAuliffe and Ann Rendell, and they're not household conservative names by any stretch. And then in the morning on Sunday, we have, with Chris Wallace, we have Mara Liasson and Juan Williams, two people I really enjoy. Don't agree with them a lot, but I still like to hear their points of view.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is it fair to say that Fox is this biased right-wing group, and they have like Alan Combs and Nina Easton and CeCe Roberts and Mara Liasson and Juan Williams. How does that work? And I guess I'd just like your guest to respond to that.
All right, Wayne. Thanks for the call.
Well, first, the Democratic primary, the candidates didn't differ very much on policy, so it's not clear what a Republican or conservative bias would have meant in Obama versus Clinton. So I just think there it wasn't clear. It's not that it wasn't a Democrat versus a Republican. It wasn't a liberal versus conservative. So there wasn't really any natural way that you'd expect a partisan out news outlet to spin it. But beyond that, I think that Fox is a Republican supporting conservative news outlet. But, that doesn't mean that they're Pravda, right? I mean, they have a lot of goals, and one of their goals is to advance their political interests. Another goal is to actually present the news and inform people and be interesting, and nobody's going to want to watch them if they're completely partisan either.
Thanks, Wayne. We have time for one more phone call. Jim from Milwaukee. Hi.
Good morning. I was wondering if the professor could comment on, there seems to be sort of an inconsistency between a lot of conservative people that, may sort of lean towards having kind of a a pro-religious or kind of Christian sort of outlook, and they sort of have a tendency to support a party that, namely Republicans, I guess you could say, that whose ideology really isn't quite as compassionate as their values would. Seems like there's sort of an incongruity there, and also it seems that a lot of people are sort of hang their hat upon kind of like the one issue of abortion, whereas that people will sort of fall in line and go in that direction kind of based on that one issue.
We have about 15 seconds, Andrew. Sorry.
Yeah, more religious people tend to be more socially conservative, but the connection between going to church and voting Republican is really something that arose since the era of Bill Clinton, starting in the 90s. It hasn't been happening forever, so certain issues have become more salient than they used to be.
Thanks, Andrew, so much for being with us. Our guest this hour, Andrew Gelman, his book is Red State, Blue State, Rich State, Poor State, Why Americans Vote the Way They Do. It has just been published by Princeton University Press. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, John Treader on air production, and thank you everybody for your wonderful calls. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.